Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Hey everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back for another amazing national grassroots emergency election protection coalition Zoom call to discuss the ins and outs of the how our elections are conducted, especially the 2020 election. We are launching this week a four-year campaign, and Joel Siegel is on with us to talk about it, to make hand-counted, hand-cast, electronically digitized paper ballots to be the center of our election system. I have posted an article at Reader Supported News. You can take a look about that very topic. Joel Siegel and I, along with Bob Petrakis and others, are co-conveners, and Ray McClendon of this national campaign. We feel that the paper ballots made a huge difference in this election, and that that should be how we do our elections future as we go along. We've already got over 90 people on the call, and we're going to continue for the next hour and a half. You at Reader Supported News, we are glad to have you on with us. You have just heard the great Pete Seeger singing with Dar Williams and David Burns, who wrote the song Solartopia. Anybody here who wants to hear this again can go to prn.fm Thursdays 5 p.m. Eastern time, or come to our grassrootsep.org website, grassrootsep.org, and you can now, thanks to Steve Caruso, also access that webpage going with electionprotection2024.org, all one word. electionprotection2024.org, all one word, and that gets you there as well. So we have a ton of stuff to go through today. We are going to focus on the deep, deep crisis that our election system faces, and also face the reality of Donald Trump. This is a nonpartisan call, so we are just stating the facts. Donald Trump still could win the 2024 election. He could do it at the state level, he could do it at the Supreme Court, and he can also do it in Congress, as Bob Petrakis will explain when the Electoral College is subject to challenge in a joint session of Congress. So Bob Petrakis is going to lead that deep discussion about how these avenues that are still available to the Trump campaign to flip over the 6 million vote count margin that came out of the popular election. So we will get to that with Bob Petrakis, Paul Leto, Pete Pekarsky, and others with deep legal knowledge. And we want you, of course, to jump in. I'm sure everybody has an opinion. I will say one thing, we're gonna go to Ray McClendon in a minute. Our great co-engineer, Steve Caruso, has responded to your every wish and set up a listserv. Steve, can you explain the listserv just for a few moments? And that will allow everybody to keep in touch through the week and put a little less strain on our chat room. Steve, do you wanna fill us in on the listserv?
Yeah, this is set up at the email I just put in the chat, solartopia@electionprotection2024.org. You would email your email to that link, and then we'll add you to the group for the listserv, the email listserv for grassroots election protection. That's the only way we can do it. I can't put a link out there. It's you just have to send your email to solartopia@electionprotection2024.org, and you will request to be on the listserv. And you've been on Google Groups. It's a Google Group listserv, so all the emails that you send will be saved there, and you can chat and talk to other people and respond and reply, so forth and so on.
Okay. Any questions about that? Thank you so much, Steve. We appreciate it. And by the way, I just recommended a movie to Steve, which he loved and which you will love. Many of you have seen it probably. It's called My Octopus Teacher. How many of you have seen My Octopus Teacher? So it has nothing to do with election protection. It's about a guy diving in a pool of water in South Africa. But you know, what the heck? It's a great movie. It's on
Netflix.
Incredible
movie.
Yeah. Incredible movie and definitely mind expanding. Everybody who sees that movie will automatically advocate for hand counted paper ballots. I can guarantee that. So at any rate, My Octopus Teacher, I'll put it in. If you have a favorite movie that's not on Pornhub, please feel free to recommend it as well. Okay, Ray, and anybody else have a bookkeeping, a housekeeping thing, that issue we're gonna talk about? This, someone has raised the issue of people being stripped from voter rolls. We have the fabulous Ray McClendon, one of our co-conveners in the four-year campaign that Joel Siegel is going to discuss in a minute. Ray, you want to talk about people being stripped from the voter rolls already? Ray McClendon of the NAACP.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Harvey. This rumor is circulating over the airwaves over the last couple of weeks. And we have confirmed both with the Secretary of State's office and with local county officials that is not true. And moreover, it's not legal in Georgia to purge voters or do any list maintenance, quote unquote, as they call it, within 90 days of a general election. So that's not the case. We've gotten direct confirmation on that directly from the Secretary of State's office and independently confirmed by county registrars.
Is that a state law or a federal law?
That's a federal law.
Cool. So under federal law, nobody is allowed to purge a voter list within 90 days of an election?
Yes.
And it is 90 days till January, is the 5th or 6th?
Well, it's within 90 days.
So they can't purge the voter rolls
before
this upcoming special election.
Yeah, they can't purge. So anyone who has been eligible, anyone who voted, anyone who is registering currently through December the 7th will be eligible to vote.
So you can still register in Georgia.
Yeah, we're still registering right now through December 7th. We have registered statewide approximately 300,000 voters over the last several weeks.
Okay.
We'll be active in that this week through Monday.
Well, Steve Rosenfeld has raised a hand. I think you guys met. Steve Rosenfeld is one of our great national reporters on election issues. It's great to have you on the call, Steve. Have you got some information on this?
Well, I would just say this. I would just encourage people to support what Ray, the NAACP, and other groups that are actually working on the ground are doing. I just spent 10 days in Georgia. There aren't a lot of groups actually working on the ground right now doing this. People are tired because the presidential race is not over. And once the focus, the registration period ends, the real focus is turning out the vote, and early voting starts a week later. So I would just emphasize that, because while there's a lot of talk of people doing stuff, there aren't that many groups that I saw actually doing it. So I just leave it right there.
Okay, Stephen, I'm glad you were able to go down there. And Paxis, you're among those coming into the state. So you want to contact the NAACP, the Atlanta NAACP. We are encouraging people. We do not ask for money on this call, but we do have available to anyone who wants to donate to any progressive group. Bob Fetrakis is 501c3 at the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism. Bob's going to be speaking in a minute, but he is getting the doing the paperwork, and sends, if you want to send money to the Atlanta NAACP, which we do support, contact Bob. Bob, how do people get a hold of you to make donations? Bob Fetrakis?
At freepress.org, the website, or columbusfreepress.com, but freepress.org is probably the best.
Okay. If you put it in the chat, that'd be great. Free Press, I can do that, actually. Freepress.org, one of the great websites. If you want to donate, there is a donate button on there, welcoming Susan Pinchon. Hi, Susan. Laura Chamberlain, you have a hand, and then Ruth Strauss.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Ray, the Greg Palast is still on the radio saying that this car registration thing is an issue. Can you go over this again?
Yeah, let me go over that again as well. That is not correct. There is no additional requirement that has been promulgated regarding any additional requirement that you have to have a car or a car registration in order to be registered to vote. We are actively registering people to vote as we speak. We've been out registering people to vote all week. As I said, we've registered 300,000 people between the November 3rd election and this past weekend at various locations around the 19 counties that we have built a coalition in. If there is an issue with an ID, someone might have been asked for either a driver's license or some other form of registration or bill or identification that said that was their correct address, but there's no requirement for any registration. That's just another one of those rumors that's floating around that is not accurate.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay. And again, hi, Laura Grace. Nice to have you.
Furthermore, that would have to be, any change like that would have to be passed by the state legislature.
Okay, glad to hear all that. And again, anybody wants to donate to the Atlanta NAACP, which is the lead group along with Andrea Miller's People Demanding Action, go to freepress.org through Bob Fetrakis and the CICJ's 501c3 and do it that way. Ruth Strauss and then Richard Tam, and then we're going to get into the bigger issues here. Ruth and then Richard. Ruth.
Okay. I was just going to say that maybe Ray can put up exactly what he needs us to do. I know that when I was thinking of going to do door leafleting and door knocking, Stacey Abrams said, and I should have known this because I'm from the South, you know, please don't come down. Georgians don't want foreigners. But anyway, so whatever we can do to help registration or texting or whatever, please let us know what you'd like.
Right.
Okay, great. That's a great point.
Please, Ray, yeah, do that.
Yeah.
And we suggest if you do go to Florida, do not bring a carpet bag, okay? Richard Tam.
Just one more question for Ray. I know a couple of years ago, there was a problem with late registrations that they didn't process them in time purposely to prevent tens of thousands of people from voting. Do you have any reassurance from the Secretary of State that they will process these late registrations in a timely manner?
That's a great question. And we cannot vouch for that system because of exactly the problem that occurred in 2018, where we had a dual problem going on. As you recall, we had not only stacks of applications for registrations that were mysteriously just set to the side. We also had the voter purge going on at that point, leading up to the governor's race. What we have been doing at the NAACP is we urge, the same way we talk about paper ballots, we like to use the paper voter registration forms, and we make copies of them with the NAACP. And then we submit them ourselves, and then we follow up on them. So we have a relationship with the office where they know that when they come in from the NAACP, we're going to be following up on them within a matter of a couple of weeks to see if they've actually been put onto the rolls.
Well, let me ask you, in this election, in this special election in Georgia, if you are a registered voter, do you have to fill out a form to get a paper ballot, or do you get one automatically?
To get an absentee ballot?
Yes.
Yes, you have to fill out an application. The process in Georgia is that, first of all, you have to fill out an application. The application you have to request. Unless you are a senior above 65 or older who requested to be signed up for this entire election cycle. So anybody who is 65 or older, if they checked it off on their first application for the primary, they will automatically get a ballot for, they automatically got a ballot for November 3rd, and then they'll get one for the runoff. Otherwise, you have to request one each time. Then, but there's ways that you can follow up. You can follow up on that. But with all of the confusion, with everything that's going on, we are urging early voting because the post office, USPS, as you all know, is a disaster. These ballots are running behind. We want to make sure with this cycle being even tighter than the general election in terms of when you could request and when you likely will receive an absentee ballot, the best methodology is to early vote.
Now, when you early vote in Georgia, if you go in person, do you vote on a machine or do you get a paper ballot?
It's a machine that produces a paper ballot.
Are you able to personally review the paper ballot before
yes,
it goes to the box?
And you actually cast it yourself.
And you put it in a scanner?
Yes.
All right, that's reasonable. That's fine. So, you know, this is critical here. So you're going to have to get people either to go in personally or to apply for a ballot and then hope they get the ballot?
Well, see, it's almost too late to apply now. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
During the primary and the general, you can start requesting a ballot 180 days out. This time frame is so tight that it's difficult to do. As an example, there's something called My Voter Page, where you can go and check on your status. Are you registered, what your polling location is, early voting, et cetera. And there's also a ballot status that will tell you if you requested an absentee ballot, has it been issued yet? As an example, I requested an absentee ballot. The My Voter Page tells me that my ballot was issued to be sent to me on November the 20th. So here we are 10 days later and I still don't have that ballot.
Wow.
Okay, so that's the challenge you have. Now, my wife and I will be able to deal with that because if we don't get it by early voting time, we can still early vote at any, and the good thing about early voting in Georgia is that you can vote at any polling location for early voting. You can only vote at your precinct location on the actual day of the election. So you have many more choices. So we're not worried about it, but that's the point. If we had not already applied for the absentee ballot, we would be late at this point in time because that we would know that it's going to take at least a week to receive, another 3 or 4 days to process the request for the ballot, and then for them to issue it, you don't know when you're going to get that ballot.
So now if you get a paper ballot and you take it in, will they accept the paper ballot or will they switch you over to the ballot marking device?
They'll switch you over. They'll cancel your absentee ballot and allow you to vote early in person.
And but do you have drop boxes in Georgia?
We do have drop boxes. Drop boxes though are sketchy in the large metropolitan areas, it ranges from, let's say, Fulton County, which is Atlanta. They have probably 40 or 50 Dropbox locations around the county. In other counties, they only have one or two in the smaller counties. So it's just a matter of where you are.
Okay. Anybody have any further questions for Ray McClendon here of the Atlanta NAACP?
Just Steve Rosenfeld. Yeah, just very quickly, Ray should tell people on this call about other organizations that are partners with the NAACP that will help get out the vote, because in rural areas, there's no public transportation. And I know that they have partner organizations that are doing that or getting ready to do that.
And it's a great question, great point. We created in coordination, first of all, we're part of a coalition, and our coalition includes the National Pan-Hellenic Council, that's otherwise known as the Divine Nine, which represents all of the African-American fraternities and sororities, the Grand Lodge of Georgia, which is the African-American Masonic organization and its sister organization called the Order of Eastern Stars, a wide variety of churches and places of worship around the state, 100 Black men and 100 Black women, which are national organizations with multiple chapters in the state. We also partner with the People's Agenda, which is a local or a statewide organization that has offices around the state, as well as the New Georgia Project, which was Stacey Abrams' first nonprofit organization that she created, which as fate would have it, Raphael Warnock was the chairman for a few years. So basically what that allows us to do is create what we call relational voter mobilization, where in the Black community, and Joel and Harvey have talked about this, and they already know this well, the ads that are run by the Democratic Party and others just don't work. You've got to have boots on the ground with influences in those communities. So all of those organizations that I just described are the pillars of those individual communities, and we've partnered with them to impact those particular communities. So what you can do is when you work through us, we're actually getting resources to those local branches and the respective coalitions of all of those organizations within the 19 counties that represent 77% of the Black vote in Georgia.
Fantastic. Now there's a couple questions in the, Laura Chamberlain wants to know if people are being advised to check the ballot that has been filled out with a ballot marking device before they put it in the scanner. That's a very-
Yeah, absolutely. I would check my ballot once it's printed to confirm your choices.
Right. One more question, Harv. One more question. Please. I didn't get a chance of typing it. So we really need to protect this election, Ray. And so I'm wondering if all of the groups are thinking about doing their own independent exit poll or auditing the voters themselves outside of the media in some way. Are you guys talking about that or thinking about it?
We have some interest in that. But I know that that's important. But the biggest challenge we've got right now is that we have got to get the vote out. Turnout in runoffs drops precipitously in the state of Georgia. And that is the way that the Republicans have been able to dominate runoffs for the last 20 years. because the progressive vote does not come back out. Now, this will be a little bit different, but where the real focus will need to be is to make sure that the people who have credibility on the ground are going door to door, canvassing, doing the virtual phone banking to let everyone know, especially number one, the people who voted November 3rd, they must get back out to vote during the early voting period going forward. We outperformed in early voting in the general. We need to do the same thing this time around. That's our number one challenge.
I just want to note there's 100 people on the call. It's nice to get in triple digits. David Morris, do you want to ask this question directly, David Morris? Are there groups working specifically with Asian or Latinx communities?
Yes, there are. And a couple of folks who are associated with this organization and this coalition are already doing that are working with you, Harvey, that I've talked to as well already, that have been in touch with some people on the ground here.
Are there formal organizations that you might name?
Not me, because I'm not really the one that's focused on that. And I see also somebody wanted to know, no, early voting starts December 14th.
Okay. And Hetty Tripp, you are working with a Muslim group, and also Hetty, a group of South Asian women, is that right, Hetty Tripp?
National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, and that's the Georgia chapter. And actually they're doing it in South Asian languages. So it's not a South Asian group, it's an Asian American women's group, but there's significant communities of South Asians that they're fetching. And then Reverend McClendon, did you connect with the Islamic group?
We've had a email back and forth, but we need to set up a conference call.
Great.
So Hetty, if you'll put the connections in the chat, and maybe you can connect directly with Ray, that would be great. Hetty's up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, but has a long, long history of activism.
I've already connected with Ray in terms of the Islamic group.
Okay, good. That's great. Thank you. Nancy Galloway, you have a hand? Nancy Galloway, does anybody else have a hand?
Hi. I was just wondering about that early voting information versus the mail-in ballot information to tell voters, because some of them might think that they're going to get a mail-in ballot in time. I just wondered, Ray's audio cut out on me and I couldn't even understand some of it. So
about that. What I was saying, that we are encouraging, if you haven't requested an absentee ballot, even requested it now, we're encouraging people to prepare to early vote starting December 14th through January 1st, Friday, January 1st. With weekend voting being the week of weekend Saturday, December 19th. That's what we're encouraging because of the lag times with USPS.
Okay. And early voting has to happen in your own precinct?
No, you can go to any polling place. The major polling places to go to for early voting will be spread around the various counties here in Atlanta, both Mercedes-Benz Stadium as well as State Farm Arena, where the pro basketball team plays, will both be early voting locations.
Wow, that's fantastic. Ruth Strauss, did you have a question, Ruth? Ruth Strauss, you have
Yeah, I did. What I was curious about is we have some great people in this group, and unfortunately they're too knowledgeable. One of them posted a map of all the counties of Georgia, and it was just a sea of red, and there were only spots of blue around Atlanta and Columbia and all of that. So my question is, how are you getting to, you know, voters that are in the quote unquote red area, blue voters who are in the red areas? Or is that something that we need to target?
Well, we start with first of all, for us, and there are progressives in every county in the state. So let me say that from the beginning. And Biden picked up those, but he really, but Biden, we're going off of the example of the general. And Biden won 30 counties in Georgia out of 159. And you can surmise what those counties are. Those would be the nine counties around Atlanta, but also the other metro markets. You have the Savannah, Chatham County, Clark County, Athens, Richmond County, Augusta, Columbus, and surrounding area, as well as Bibb County, Macon, and Houston County. So what we have done is we focused on the top 19 of those. Now there are other organizations that are going after more of those 30 counties. And then the Georgia NAACP that has that is working much beyond the 19 that we're focused on. So we've got different tiers and different layers of organizations that we are in coalition with that are working a broader spectrum. As an example, Andrea Miller's group with the Center for Common Ground is also doing some of that work, and we're in coalition with them as well. So people are looking at different layers. So they're going to be touched.
Great, thanks.
Thank you very much. This is good. We're going to move on to the big picture questions. We had one more hand up. Who did I miss here? Someone else had a hand.
Yeah, I had my
hand ahead. Up.
One of my questions was, when you take, you know, if you are going to go and vote in person, but you have a ballot, you know, an absentee ballot, do you have to take the envelope plus the ballot in?
No, you just need to turn in the actual ballot so it can be canceled.
Okay. And then another question was, what's being done about the young people who are turning 18 by January 5th? They can be registered. Is anybody working on them?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're working with the school systems. Most of them are virtual right now. So we are having to coordinate with the assistant superintendents in various counties. We'll, as an example, we will be doing a Zoom session with the Atlanta Public School High Schools. I believe it's this Thursday. To register high school seniors who will turn 18 by January 5th.
Good for you. Excellent. Well, we have one more hand up or two. Julie Wiener, Melody Patek, and then we're going to go to the Bob Fetrakis and the big mega discussion here. I just want to
underline and make sure that you're talking to all the organizations that you're in touch with who are doing Get Out the Vote, to get people, to really remind people strongly, double check your ballots, because ballot marking devices can be hacked. So make sure your ballot says the right person on it. And also, I'm concerned that people be told specifically, you're allowed to turn it in and get a new one. If you have to, you could do that up to twice or three times, whatever the number is. Because here we are watching the we know long-term how elections can be hacked and rigged.
Good, thank you for that. That's very good. Melody Pajak? Melody?
Yes. Mike, I put my question in the chat, but I don't know if it will be seen. With the absentee ballots, is it possible to fill out the ballot and personally, in person, take the ballot to the Board of Elections in your county so that you know that they received it?
Yes.
Yes. I assume there are drop boxes at these election boards also.
There are drop boxes. There are drop boxes, but you can physically deliver it to your county registrar.
Okay. Wow. Ray, that was really great. I hope you're going to be on all our calls in the future. You are a wealth of information and activism, and we really, really appreciate having you on with us. I think we've gone through the questions. And now, as advertised, is there anything else you want to say, Ray?
No, that's good. I'll be monitoring the chat. If anybody's got any other questions for me, just shoot them to me and I'll respond as we go.
And remember, again, we have a listserv now, and I'm sure it'll be used. And also, I do have a piece at Reader Supported News about much of this. So there you go. And that link is also in the box. Okay, now we want to look at the bigger picture of this election. It is still possible, not likely, but possible, legally possible, for the popular vote to be flipped, specifically through state legislatures, possibly through the Supreme Court, possibly, and in a process that virtually nobody knows about, and it's been only used once in American history, when the electors arrive at the Congress. Now, there's been a note in the chat saying none of this is going to happen, and so move on. we all got to wake up with some kind of peace, and we need to know what's going on. And also, I want to emphasize that we are starting a four-year movement to, reform our election system. And the fact that such backdoor maneuvers are possible is something we have to deal with. I mean, everybody knows by now that the election system in this country, which is embedded in this Article 2 of the Constitution, and then has gone through the 12th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 20th Amendment, the 24th Amendment, the Electoral Choice Act of 1877. I mean, we have heard repeatedly since November 3rd that there is a lot of stuff about how we choose a president that is simply unclear and that is arbitrary, and much of it is unprecedented. And for example, we even have a precedent in our electoral system where the Supreme Court said this is not to be used as a precedent, which is Bush v. Gore. But if you read the current filings by the Trump campaign, they cite Bush v. Gore. So we are lucky to have with us Bob Fitrakis. He is an attorney, a constitutional expert, and an election protection expert. Been doing it since El Salvador in the 90s, and he and I have co-authored more books than we can remember, literally. But I want to, quickly, by the way, Anna Georgie, it's great to have you on. Jill Stein is on with us. Marion Edie, great to have you on. We're still at 100 people. So let's go. Bob, can you explain to us, and people put your questions in the chat, raise your hand, we will discuss this. But the reality of the matter is that the electoral system is not done. This election is not over. However slim the chance that the 6 million vote margin that appears to be in place for Joe Biden might be, it is a legal possibility that it will be overturned and can be overturned. And we want to change that in the next 4 years. So Bob, can you lay out for us what the realities are here? And then Paul Leto and Pete Pekarsky will join in.
Yeah, just a few things. I'll let Paul, who's been writing regularly, and Pete sort of look at some of the details, and Ray Lutz has actually been doing some very good posting as well. But one thing to keep in mind is that I remember when in Bush v. Gore, if you looked at the dictum in Scalia, essentially pointing out the obvious, right? There's nothing in the Constitution, that requires that the popular vote be linked to the electors, right? So New York Times did an article just recently pointing out that, you know, if somebody was, that all of it's really based on good faith, right? But if you create a narrative, and those of you who have been following the narratives, I remember reading the stuff on Dominion and saying, this looks like stuff me and Harvey wrote, you know, 12 years ago. Brad, Brad at BradBlog, of course, is complaining the same thing. They're talking about the fact, and I wrote a paper at the American Political Science Association arguing that American elections are fundamentally illegitimate because they're ultimately non-transparent, because we don't know who's coding the machines. We allow private, partisan, for-profit entities. So that's what's being raised here. Now, all of the things that in the recent lawsuits in Michigan, in Georgia, they've raised issues that in many ways are generally factually true, but to a large extent, you know, lack evidence. So ultimately, these cases, if one or two judges rules in a certain way, because the goal is clear, what you want to do is stop there from being 270 electors. So it goes into the House. And in that process, it then goes to vote by state, where the Republicans, if they go along party line, should in fact win, you know, with 26 states based on the new Congress. And again, I would not easily dismiss these suits. I mean, the one great success in deal that was struck, of course, by Trump was to stack the courts, the federal courts, with the most extreme right-wing Federalist Society judges. So a ruling here, an appeal there, and suddenly it's up to the Supreme Court. But so with that in mind, let me ask Paul Leydo how seriously he thinks we should take this. He seems to be taking it very seriously. And then I'll be following up with Pete Pekarsky, Ray Lutz, and of course, it's also been written about it. One of the best things written was when Steve Rosenfeld took a look at the academics. And the thing I pulled from his article is they don't know. Right? All we know is that it's a possibility and there's numerous lawsuits. So with that in mind, go ahead, Paul, give us your key thoughts.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's like about five ways to win the presidency. Only one of them is election. Bob's already mentioned you can win it in the House. It's one state, one vote, so Republicans win. You can win it in the Supreme Court. They've got six originalists on the Supreme Court. Republicans win. You can win it in the state legislatures. Republicans control all the legislatures in all of the battleground states except for Nevada. They can win there. Basically, the only way Biden wins is with a normal vote count that proceeds without any further disputes. Here's the problem is that election is only a component. It's only one part of the presidential election. We all know that ultimately it's selected by the Electoral College, or we think that's the case. But think about January 6th. Some of us were involved in the movement to unseat or not seat the Ohio electors a number of years ago. Had we won that, it could have changed the outcome of the presidency, and we would not have thought that was the least bit unjust. So don't think that the Republicans can't do this. We tried to do it ourselves. On top of that, don't think that state legislatures won't do it. Why? Think about the National Popular Vote Project, where we're trying to make the constitutional amendment to make the popular vote actually count. What does that involve? Well, 16 states plus DC have ratified this. In other words, they've made it part of their law that if the popular vote in those states go a certain way, they will pledge their electors to the winner of the popular vote, not the winner of the vote in their particular state. So the whole National Popular Vote Project already has 16 blue states plus DC on record as saying, we're going to say, forget about the results of the election in our state. We're going to vote some other way. So it would be rank hypocrisy to think the Republicans would be unwilling or unable to do the same thing. Okay. So there's a real problem here. You clearly can go to state legislatures and ask them to, you know, pledge their electors. Think of it this way. If I'm a legislature in a state and I delegate my authority to decide the electors, which the Constitution clearly says that I have, and I say, let's do this by election instead. But I don't, you know, and I say hand counted paper ballots and instead they use DREs. And like, man, I don't like that procedure. Do you think I'm powerless to say, you know, forget it. You guys didn't do what I said. So now I'm just going to vote the electors the way I want to vote them. I think it's reasonable to think that I have that power. You know, if I delegate the power and they screw it up, that I can then vote the electors a different way. So that would be the fundamental case that they would make in the state legislatures. Now, is this going to happen? Somebody said, nah, forget about it. It ain't going to happen. I beg to differ. Pennsylvania already has a resolution originally co-sponsored by 26 representatives to declare that the presidential election is in dispute and to pledge the electors to Trump. So it's already happening. Think of it, the presidential election, as a presidential selection. It could be selected by the Supreme Court. It could be selected by the state legislatures. It's ultimately always selected by Congress when they count the votes because they can object and not count those votes. So in the presidential selection, this is a huge political battle. And that's what people don't understand. And if we ignore all the lawsuits and say, you know, Trump's got 40 some odd lawsuits and he's lost almost all of them. There's like two or three wins, but those got reversed. You're missing the point. The point is this is politics, not ballots. The election is not over because it's a selection, okay? Trump's, every time he loses a lawsuit, it's another major propaganda blitz to his base to say, look, this election is illegitimate. So he's getting a weeks long head start on convincing his base that we need to make the move in the state legislatures, or we need something to happen in the Supreme Court, or we need to object in Congress. So when we blow off Trump litigation as being loser, 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 you're missing the point. It's about politics. It's about convincing the hearts and minds of the base. And when I say, and that's all they need is their base, because again, the Republicans control the state legislatures and all of these different battleground states, except for Nevada. So all they need are Republican votes. All they need are Republican votes to change the outcome of the presidency. So we need to realize that the presidency is still in play, and people need to realize that it's a political debate, not an election. The election is just one component of it. Now, what are the chances in the Supreme Court? There are already two cases that have been in the Supreme Court for a couple of months that would be the vehicle to do this. They're not necessary, although the Supreme Court has already written that they may accelerate review. The briefs are due today. They probably just got filed right now. The Supreme Court has a conference on Friday. They could accelerate review and come out with an opinion that would just lay out what the originalists, the six originalists on the Supreme Court, already think. They already think that legislatures are possessed of plenary powers, meaning total power to decide how their electors are going to be pledged. And it's not, you know, given what their views are, it's not at all impossible that they would come out with an opinion that would say the legislature is the appropriate place to decide if the election was fair or not. I would expect them to say, look, courts are, we can't you know, get to the merits on 40 some odd lawsuits in a period of a couple of weeks or 4 weeks after the election. The legislature is the only vehicle that can sort out these claims on the merits and have a vote. So it would come down as a semi-reasonable opinion that courts are ill-equipped to deal with these huge issues on an emergency basis, that ultimately the presidency is a political question, which is what they said in Bush versus Gore, and the Supreme Court can just pretend that we're going to stay out of politics. They're going to say, we learned our lesson from Bush versus Gore. We're staying out of politics. The proper place to resolve these questions is in the Congress and in the state legislatures. So, like I said, the cases are already in the Supreme Court, in the legislature. All they need are Republican votes, and the game is on. The resolutions have already been filed.
There's a question about the Supreme Court decision on faithless electors. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Supreme Court decision on faithless electors was based on the idea that it's not an election, that the electors are free to, the losing side said the electors are free to decide in their good conscience who they want to vote for. That position went down. Now, the two guys, Larry Lessig and whoever the other one was that brought this case, have written that they don't think the state legislature is going to actually, that this isn't going to happen because they feel the case, that they lost their case, you know, that electors are free to be faithless. But all the Supreme Court actually held is that legislatures are free to punish or replace faithless electors. So in other words, that decision is totally consistent with the idea that the real power is the state legislature, not the electors.
What role does the governor play?
Well, the governor signs the certificate of ascertainment based on certifications and stuff like that. And that does put the electors one step closer to operating in the normal fashion. But other than that, the governor doesn't really have a role because the state legislature is deemed to be operating or doing what's called a federal function. So a better example would be a constitutional amendment. If a legislature is going to vote on a federal constitutional amendment, the Supreme Court of that state, the executive branch has nothing to say. They can't tell the legislature anything. The legislature acts alone because it is performing a federal function under the federal constitution. The same thing applies with the plenary power under the Electors Clause. The legislature is performing a federal function. The governor has nothing to say about it. The Supreme Court has nothing to say about it. And that view has already won in the Supreme Court recently, right before the election in the Pennsylvania case, Pennsylvania Republican Party versus Buchvar, where they said that this Pennsylvania Supreme Court, when they said they extended the deadline for receiving ballots by 3 days, you know, that was a 4-4 decision, but basically they said, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't have, it was a tie decision, but they held the Supreme Court doesn't have the power of Pennsylvania, does not have the power to change what the legislature's rules are for the election. So basically the view of the originalists, and Amy Coney Barrett wasn't involved in before the election, the view of the originalists is that the state legislature makes the rules alone and nobody, not even the state Supreme Court, has anything to say about it.
Wow. Bob, did you want to jump in on that?
What about the Congress? Wait a second. What about the...
Yeah, I was going to let Pete go. Go ahead, Pete, and offer you...
This is Pete Pekarsky. Pete is an attorney based in Washington, originally from Madison, Wisconsin.
Two presidential recounts, been part of the only two in U.S. history on some level. Go ahead, Pete.
Pete, you're muted.
You're muted, Pete. Go ahead.
I'm unmuted as far as I can tell.
Yeah, now you are. Go ahead.
The real question, first off, the Congress has already spoken, there is an additional role for the governor in the statutes. Now, who's going to decide whether the statute controls or that constitutional provision, the arguable provision as to whether the legislatures can pick the electors. The rule in the statute, you know, then the question is going to be, okay, what controls the statute? And who is going to decide what controls the statute, which says that if you have two ascertainments from a state, the one that gets preference is the one from the executive of the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so who is about to decide if the Supreme Court's going to stay out of it? They're not going to decide that conflict. It's going to be up to the House and the Senate to decide the conflict. But the real issue here is whether the real issue is the type of government we have, the expectations we have, the normative expectations we have. What they are talking about doing, particularly on the cases that have been brought, the one in Georgia and the one in Michigan, those cases could have been filed on November 4th. If they had these facts then, and their view of it is they did, maybe a few days later. And as a matter of fact, there was a clear provision in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. If they had a question about this, they could have raised it a long time ago. They didn't have to wait until November 25. They could have gone into court, as I told this audience and a number of other audiences, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and tried to preserve the evidence, which is what they're trying to do now with the order to hold on to at least some of the machines in some of the counties in Georgia. What they're talking about and what you're considering here is something far worse than Justice Antonin Scalia, may he rest in peace, throwing out 400 years of Anglo-American jurisprudence one Saturday afternoon to put somebody other than the person who was selected when people went to the polls in the office. We're talking about something far worse than this. The pleadings, the complaints here, and the exhibits, such as they've made them available, do not cut it. Now, by do not cut it, I mean they're insufficient to grant the relief sought. If you want to just ignore it and view this as some vehicle to decide whether we're going to have a one person, one vote, one day election, and that vote goes to Amy Barrett, that in one sense is not the understanding that 330 million people were operating under. But, you know, and Paul may have a point. It may be that is precisely what's going to happen. That would not speak well for our government, our country, or the people in it. Let me go on to these. As far as the complaints and the so-called evidence supporting them, I'm not going to get too far into it, but there are some affidavits. And I'm not going to explain precisely what's wrong with the affidavits, because I'm going to leave that to defense counsel to do it in court. Suffice it to say, there are real serious questions about the affidavits submitted in support of the case in Georgia and the case in Michigan. And there may be further cases to come. Ray Lutz, who's on this call, wrote a reasonably good, I thought good, technical analysis, sort of at a high level, on some of the issues with the technical affidavit which was submitted. With luck, Ray will say a few words on this later. There are several other issues which in a normal court proceeding you must deal with. First off, these people are showing up and saying they're experts. Well, there happens to be a Supreme Court decision dealing with allowing expert opinion in. It's called Daubert. That doesn't cut it. They have released the affidavits and then gone to court and said, now we want to protect the names of these people.
The one thing we know for sure is that hand-counted, digitally scanned paper ballots do make the difference. So Steve and Rich will call on you next week. Thank you so much, everybody.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar trophy.